Greetings and welcome to It's About Florida. Joining us in the studio is Mr. Dave Royce with the News Service of Florida and Ms. Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times.
Hello.
Greetings. Hey. And we are here to talk about what passed, what failed, and what could be popping up next year. And Dave, let's start with you from your observations. How'd they do?
Well, I thought it was a well-managed session. Next year, I think before we even get to next year, we probably ought to talk about what might show up in a special session because I think, you know, one of, let's say, three or four major issues that the legislature had before it that they did not pass was any form of expanding health care coverage for the uninsured. And that's something that I'm not sure they're going to wait till next year to try to come back and do. I mean, there's all kinds of talk about a special session. There's a whole lot of federal money on the table, left on the table by the legislature this year, $50 billion to expand health care coverage. And eventually, the federal health care law is going to kick in and everybody's going to have some sort of coverage or face tax penalties. And we're going to be there soon. And Florida hasn't done anything to help those people who have no health insurance get it. And I think that we might see legislators back here before next year to deal with that.
Tia, you covered that a lot, the Medicaid expansion issue, as well as, you know, what will Florida do as an alternative. Obviously, that part of the federal health care law kicks in January of 2014. So they only have a couple of months to figure out what to do, or else they risk losing a few billion dollars off that year one. Talk a little bit about, you know, what you saw.
I think it's interesting. We talked to House Speaker Will Weatherford, and he told us that he didn't see the point of coming back in special session if the different ideologies of the House, the Senate, and the governor had not changed. So that's where we are right now. House Republicans blocked a deal, and the governor and the Senate and House Democrats were all in agreement on a plan that would draw down that federal money that Dave suggested, that he mentioned. But House Republicans, who of course had the majority, blocked it. And so until House Republicans agree that drawing down that federal money is the right thing to do, Speaker Weatherford said, what's the point in coming back to for a special session? We're still ideologically opposed. So Governor Scott in the state, in the Senate, they've been trying to kind of work on some different plans, some alternatives, hoping that they could get House Republicans on board. But so far, there has not been anything put on the table that seems palpable, because not only do they not want to draw down that federal money, they also have decided that childless adults are a low priority, that they don't necessarily see the benefit in covering them right now.
And those childless adults, under the federal health law, that's the main expansion population.
It is.
Low-income childless adults.
It is. It's probably about half of the expansion population is childless adults. So without covering them, so far the federal government has said, you either cover everybody or we don't give you a dime.
But as we get closer to the election, the pressure is going to mount, because generally people think this is a good idea. Governor Scott got a lot of criticism for – you know, he was in favor of expanding Medicaid. He got a lot of criticism for not really sort of putting his shoulder to the wheel and doing anything about it during the session. He got his other big priorities, but he was kind of absent on this issue. And that's another thing. He's going into a reelection year. So it'll be interesting to see what he does on that.
And I was actually going to go there, because, you know, in his State of the State speech, he talked about he couldn't in good conscience deny access to health care to approximately a million people who would have qualified for this. How does this help him? Does this hurt him going into 2014? And how does that balance with the governor getting pretty much everything else he wanted, with the teacher raises, the state employee raises, and his manufacturing tax breaks? He got 3 out of 4.
Yeah, I think it hurts him. I think that, again, it's a popular issue. He can, of course, blame House Republicans. That's a dicey game. It's his own party. But he can say, look, I was in favor of it. But the bottom line is he didn't get it done. So I think it does hurt him a little bit. But that teacher pay raise, and I guess I'm segging for you to the next issue here, but that's a big deal. And I think he's gonna run. Well, he's not going to run. He already is running on the fact that they passed a teacher. They put money in the budget for a teacher pay raise. Not exactly the way he wanted, but they put $480 million in the budget to raise teacher pay. The session ends on a Friday, and on Monday, Governor Scott has three school stops flying around the state touting, teacher pay raises.
He's on a victory tour.
He is.
And I think both of them show just kind of how Governor Scott is working with the legislature, who definitely is not necessarily treating him as the leader of their party and someone who they feel the need to just instantly fall in line with. For example, on Medicaid expansion, he took the lead before session began. He said, this is something I think the state should do to draw down that federal money. And House Republicans wouldn't go along with him. And same thing with teacher pay. He said early on he wanted across the board raises for teachers. And both Republicans in the House and Senate said, no, we think it should be tied to merit. And at the end of the day, the teacher raises will be tied to merit. So, they're partial victories, and it still leaves Governor Scott open to a little bit of criticism, especially on Medicaid expansion, because now there are people saying he should do more. He should be more of a leader. He should put himself out there more than he has.
He also is going to take credit for his other big priority, the governor's other big priority, which was a tax break for manufacturers when they buy new equipment. The tax break sort of exists now, but the manufacturers have to jump through some hoops to get it. And the governor wanted to eliminate that process and basically make all new equipment for manufacturing completely – you don't pay sales tax on it. So he got it, sort of. they delayed it, so it doesn't go into effect until 2014. Is that right? Or it doesn't go into effect until later anyway. And they're only doing it for 3 years. So he got his manufacturing tax cut, but it's a partial manufacturing tax cut, not quite the way he wanted it. So that's, sort of two things he got and one big thing he didn't get.
And it's also the way the vote was carried out. It kind of leaves the tax cut itself on shaky ground, because before the vote, even the governor's office had put out literature saying it required a 2/3 majority because it affects county tax kind of revenue. The staff analysis of the bill said it needed a 2/3 majority. And then when the House approved the tax break, they do it on just a straight 50% majority vote. It did not get the 2/3 threshold. So it still remains to be seen whether that vote itself is even valid.
Right.
And there are already threats of lawsuits.
Right,
I think the Democrats said immediately afterward that they had every intention of somebody is going to file that.
Right.
Poor the governor. Every time he goes and tries to do something, it usually ends in a lawsuit. There's usually a couple lawsuits that come after these things. State employees. How did they fare? Obviously, they decided on a sliding scale system with increases between $1,000 and $1,400. How does this work out for them? Is this a win for state employees, considering, they've now had to start paying 3% of their pay into pensions? They haven't had raises in a couple years.
It doesn't get them back to where they would have been had they not had to kick in 3% of their salary for their pensions. Most of them would rather have that 3% eliminated, I think. However, of course it's a win. They get a pay raise. And it's been 7 years since they've had one. They had a bonus in there at some point, but they haven't had an actual recurring pay raise for 7 years. So I think they'll take it. Sure. Would they much rather have, more take-home pay? Of course they would. But, it's a raise. And I think it's one of the things, along with the money for teacher pay raises and a couple other things, that have sort of been lingering out there for several years. And I think a lot of Republican legislators would like to have done this earlier. The fact is, the money wasn't there. We've been in a terrible recession for 4 or 5 years, and now the money's coming back. It's a lot easier to do things for people when you're writing a state budget and you've got extra money. And that was sort of the theme of the budget this year, is that, there were all kinds of things that, they were able to do for people like state workers and for teachers that they couldn't do before because of the economy.
You know, one of the things we saw this year was a big push for pension reform, retirement reform. State employees are probably breathing a sigh of relief, but that was House Speaker Will Weatherford's top priority, to kind of get rid of the pension system altogether and transition everyone into 401k style plan. That did not happen. What happened there for him?
I definitely think the Senate, you know, decided that that was something that too big of a shift too quickly, and they just decided not to go along with what House Speaker Weatherford wanted. And that's hard to do. You know, he's a major figure. The House and the Senate were trying very hard this year to work together. But what happened in the Senate is Democrats flexed their muscle. And in the Senate, because they have smaller numbers, because they tend to be more seasoned politicians, and because they tend to represent broader districts that have less homogenous kind of makeup, you tend to have much more moderate Republicans in the Senate. They're much more likely to break with the party line and do, quote unquote, what they think is right. And so you had enough Republicans who voted with Democrats to block that pension deal from happening in the Senate.
You know, that moderate Senate is interesting because there had been a lot of hope hung on them that they would do something this year that they failed to do last year, and that was to pass the parent trigger bill, right? The idea was, okay, all of these moderate Republicans that voted against the bill last year are now gone, replaced by those who are supposedly supposed to be more conservative, and then boom, parent trigger bill, which would have given, you know, parents a greater say on the fate of failing schools, it fails again for the second year in a row.
Yeah, so I think the idea that the Senate is not as, you know, has lost all its moderates, I think is a little overblown. I think everything that Tia just said about the nature of the Senate sort of keeps it moderate no matter who's in there. It sort of has a moderating impact on the actual senators. I also think the details of that bill are important. The bill didn't really do much this year. The bill was amended so that it said that essentially, you know, when a school is failing, the parents can basically – they can petition the school district as to what they want to happen to that school. But the school district would keep the ultimate say. They didn't really have to listen to the parents. So I think a lot of senators in that vote took a look at that situation and said, well, this doesn't really change much. So why am I going to hang myself out here and get beat up by the teachers union and the, you know, parents, the PTA, for, you know, going into my next election if I'm, you know, if this doesn't really change anything? And so I think that's part of what happened
there. And I also think the dynamic of the argument, even the supporters of the law will tell you that this is not a grassroots initiative. This comes from former Governor Jeb Bush and his organization, and it comes from the Parent Revolution Organization in California, which is aligned with former Governor Bush and his organization. And so, you know, when you look and see if you're a senator or a representative and your constituents aren't necessarily asking for this legislation, you get petitions and people say, well, I didn't know what I was signing, or that wasn't me. You get a video that supposedly is from parents who support it, and they say, well, those parents don't even live in Florida who are in the video. And so that just, I think that really hurt the marketing campaign, and it became clearer and clearer that this was not something that many parents in Florida were behind. So again, like Dave said, I think that makes it harder for senators to want to support, because you know the fallout.
You're listening to It's About Florida. We've been speaking with the Tampa Bay Times' Tia Mitchell and the News Service of Florida's Dave Royce about the impact of the 2013 legislative session. Now back to the conversation. Switching gears here just a bit, when session first started, House Speaker Will Weatherford, Senate President Don Gates laid out, you know, their kind of three top priorities: ethics, elections, and campaign finance reform. The elections bill was the last one to get through, but ultimately all three of those proposals did get through. How did they do on those?
Well, I mean, I think with the exception of the pension reform, which was also a priority of Speaker Weatherford, as you mentioned earlier, I mean, I think they had a good session. I mean, the elections bill, was the most interesting to me of all of those. You know, everybody remembers those reported long lines, especially in South Florida last election day. And, you know, people still waiting in line to vote after we knew that President Obama had already defeated Mitt Romney. And, you know, the Republican legislature in this state has spent the better part of, I don't know, 4 years, maybe 6 years, essentially trying to make it harder to vote. Now, you can talk all day about what the motivations are, and you know, there's a legitimate dispute there about what those motivations are. Republicans say, look, it's fraud. There's all kinds of fraud, and we need to stop. You know, a vote audit, you ought to know that when you vote, your vote counts because there's no fraud out there. Democrats say they're trying to make it harder for Democrats to vote. You know, they're trying to basically rig elections. So after years and years of going in one direction, the public outcry, I think, has gotten to the point where Republicans went back the other direction this year. This bill allows for election supervisors to increase the number of days of early voting after years of trying to get them to decrease the amount of voting that was available. It's remarkable to me. And I think it doesn't happen all that often, but there are times when the public outcry for something is so loud and that it is well heard and that legislation occurs. And again, I don't think this happens very often, but legislation occurs because people demand something, not because an interest group wants something or because politics has intervened, although obviously this is a political issue, but because the public said, you know, you guys are making it harder to vote and we don't like it. And they went the other way.
And I also think Florida was the butt of one too many punchlines this
Absolutely.
Last election season. And that's something that I think the state is, you know, it shouldn't have to be old Florida every time a major election comes out. I think it'll be interesting to see. There's a lot of flexibility, as Dave mentioned, in this law. It mandates certain amount of early voting, and then it gives individual supervisors of elections different flexibility to expand that to more days, more hours. So you would expect, especially in the bigger counties like your Miami-Dade and Broward and Orange and Duval and probably even Leon, to see, you know, more early voting, more days, more sites, but you don't have to do it. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how it's implemented in the next few months.
You know, also piggybacking on elections, campaign finance and ethics, those two kind of go hand in hand. The ethics bill gives the State Ethics Commission a little bit more power to collect those fines that have been building up for about 10 years. And the campaign finance bill eliminates those committees of continuing existences, what everybody knows as the slush funds. Clearly, I can't say the word existences today. But it also raises the campaign contribution limits. They're now up to, what, $3,000?
For statewide races.
For governor. Governor Rick Scott wasn't originally too fond of that, but ultimately he ended up signing off on them.
Well, he doesn't need the money.
Yeah, he doesn't need the money. And I think he signed off because, quite frankly, the legislature kind of played a little bit of political chess. They gave him the bills early, which meant he had to sign them while the session was still at hand and while his manufacturing tax break was still on the table. So he could either veto them and make a few enemies in the legislature right when one of his priorities was on the line, or sign them and make friends with the legislature while his priorities were on the line. So not that that was his only reasoning, I'm sure, but I'm sure he had to be thinking about that because of the timing. But it also raises for the lawmakers, it raises their campaign contribution limits to $1,000. They argued that it had been
from
500 to 1,000. So they argued that it had been many years. And I think, again, that's going to be very interesting to see how this law is actually implemented. You know, you're getting rid of the CCEs, as you mentioned, Lynn, but now lawmakers can have political action committees, which kind of still can have unlimited campaign donations. They have a wide range of flexibility as to what they can spend the money for. But the goal was set the CCEs, you know, we had, you know, accusations that they were used maybe for not the the way they were intended.
For personal expenses.
For personal
People
expenses.
People were living off of them.
Exactly. So it'll be interesting to see just kind of what the real application of this law is for the next campaign.
Wasn't the original idea like more transparency in exchange for – you know,
yes,
greater ability to raise money, because you're not going to get the money out of the system.
Right. And arguably there may be some greater transparency. But I'm very pessimistic about campaign finance reforms in general. I think that campaign financing is the proverbial rock on Jell-O. You know, you make a dent somewhere and the money in the system just pops up somewhere else. People who want to spend money and organizations who want to spend money on campaigns will find a way to do it. And, you know, you can tinker with the mechanisms around the edges, but it's ultimately very few changes will ever be made.
Some education issues that did pop up this year, just to kind of switch gears a bit. Higher education, there is again a tuition increase, even though the governor said he didn't want that. And there's also the concept of university preeminence, and the final product looks a whole heck of a lot different than what was originally considered. Part of the original preeminence concept was giving schools more tuition freedom. At the end of the day, that's clearly not in there, and it's online university.
Well, last year, Governor Scott vetoed the preeminence bill specifically because it did have a tuition component and because he opposes tuition increases. So this year, they took a different approach early on. And what they did is, instead of tying preeminence to the ability to raise higher tuition, they tied preeminence to extra state funding. And so Florida State and University of Florida are the two preeminent universities thus far. And they each got $15 million. Because of their preeminence. And then UF, being the most preeminent of the two, got an additional $15 million to create an online university arm, which is a priority of Speaker Weatherford. He really pushed for more online learning. But it's going to happen through University of Florida. And then, of course, all the individual universities still have their own online distance learning components. So that's preeminence. And so that was much less controversial this year. The tuition increase, we'll see when Governor Scott decides what he's going to do about the budget. He has to sign it into law or veto it or do what he wants to
and
do
with
it.
And he has line item veto power.
And well, but that's kind of in question as well. Governor Crist vetoed tuition just as a line item in 2010.
Right.
And even then, there were people who said he could not legally do that, but no one kind of stepped up to the plate to actually challenge it in court.
Let me ask this question, though. Is that enough of an incentive to make a university want to even bother with the preeminence concept? I could see them maybe jumping at $100 million, but jumping at $15 million?
Well, I think it's kind of – the money is not the motivation. The rankings, the national prestige is the motivation, and the money just comes with that. So in that case, every university, as much as they don't care, they say they don't care, they do care. As much as they, you know, complain that the U.S. News and World Report rankings are a flawed methodology and it's based on reputation – they revel in it. They look at it. They know exactly what number they are.
They all put out a press release when they're on it.
Absolutely. They want that. That prestige is what helps bring more students and bring more acclaim and bring better faculty.
Governor Scott looks at this primarily as a consumer issue. He's running for reelection, and universities don't vote, and students and their parents, particularly their parents, do. And Governor Scott was against tuition increase, not because he doesn't want universities to succeed, but because he doesn't want to saddle Floridians with additional out-of-pocket expenses. Not increasing the cost of living. You hear him say that all the time. He doesn't want to increase the cost of living for everyday Floridians and if possible, to decrease it.
So as we begin to wrap up, you know, who's winning and who's losing in 2013?
I would say that's an interesting question. I would say that in many ways, Democrats are winning because even though they're not the majority in the legislature, in the Senate, they helped kill parent trigger. They helped kill pension reform. In the House, even though they didn't kill anything, they raised a big ruckus for 2 days that brought a lot of attention on House Republicans blocking the Medicaid expansion deal that everyone else had agreed to. So, you know, they're coming off of election, their numbers are growing, and I think they're feeling really confident about what they were able to do this session. I do still think that Speaker Weatherford, President Gates, and Governor Scott are winners. They all, for the most part, got their priorities done, and for the most part, they all got along, at least, you know, in the public eye. I would say that teachers and state workers are winners.
Definitely.
Because they got their raises.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you know, the obvious loser is the uninsured Floridian, the person who doesn't have health insurance because nothing got done on that issue. And then we don't have time to talk about it, but the Miami Dolphins are losers.
And all the sports teams, yeah. None of them got their financial aid.
Yeah, the legislature basically said no state money for teams that want to renovate their stadiums.
Well, Dave Royce, Tia Mitchell, thank you both for joining us here on It's About Florida.
We'll see you next year.
Enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thanks to News Service of Florida's Dave Royce and the Tampa Bay Times' Tia Mitchell. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. I'm Lynn Hatter. Taylor Cox provided technical assistance. Please join us again next week for more discussion on the issues impacting our state.